as I was saying, I don't happen to like Bertrand Russell, but again, you've got to stand back and say he really was something of an individual, an interesting guy, and he accomplished a great deal. He had many honors, many people who hated him, and his contribution to philosophy is monumental. In the case of the other philosophers you've looked at, I've tried to give you something of a bibliography of what they've written. Trust me, I don't have time to even begin to list the titles of the books. Now, we could pick out a few here and there, but I mean, there are so many that they virtually fill a column, you know, of just titles, 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 titles. He wrote and he wrote and he wrote. Many things having to do with technical issues like studies on Leibniz, mathematics, philosophy of math, lots of philosophy and lots of social commentary, and then other sorts of things. One thing that's interesting to me is that he tended to write a lot about himself. What I believe, you know, and my autobiography and those sorts of things. In the most general sense, I would say that the positive contribution of Bertrand Russell, I have to be positive because when I get done here I'm going to be very negative about him, but the positive contribution of Bertrand Russell was to show the need for rigorous, logical analysis when we do philosophy. Rigorous, logical analysis. And that can be appreciated. Many times people are led to false, sometimes nonsensical, and many times dangerous conclusions because they have not been rigorous in analyzing what they're saying and what inferences can be drawn. They haven't been as logical as they should be. We can thank Bertrand Russell for exemplifying, if you will, in his life, the desire to be rigorously logical. The driving force behind Bertrand Russell's push for logical rigor was his interest in mathematics. Because after all, in mathematics, we can gain certainty. If we were to have a political discussion today, let's say we were to talk about Bill Clinton's Haiti policy. Everybody, even if we were to come to full agreement, by the way, but we might not, but everyone would leave the room and say, yeah, well, this is kind of soft, you know, you can't be absolutely certain about these things. But if we were to have a discussion about whether 3 squared equals 9, it wouldn't take very long, and we'd all know that we've gained certainty here. And so Russell was drawn to math, even as Frege was, as the paradigm of knowledge. Indeed, when he writes of his life, he says that a great event took place when he was 11 years old, his discovery of geometry. Okay, you have to remember, when we looked at John Stuart Mill, people in those days had precocious children. They learned Latin and Greek from 3 years old, you know, and read Plato before they were teenagers and things like that. Russell was doing geometry when he was 11 years old. Well, think about, I'm just being psychological here, but think about the effect that would have. Because in geometry, what happens? You move discursively from one premise through another. With rigorous analysis, you can have certainty at the end of your chain of reasoning. An 11-year-old starts out that way, and he looks at all the other stuff that's uncertain in philosophy and politics and what people are talking about. It's not surprising that Russell would see math as the great model here. Russell once wrote, quote, "I wanted certainty in the kind of way in which people want religious faith." I hope you'll write that down. I think it's extremely significant. I wanted certainty in the kind of way in which people want religious faith. Russell wanted to know what kinds of things exist. What's the inventory of the universe? He had a deep interest in metaphysics. What's the nature of the world? And he admitted, and I'm quoting, that when all was said and done, he was unwillingly forced to the conclusion that most of what passes for knowledge is open to reasonable doubt. It's not the conclusion he wanted to come to, but after all the trial and error in the many phases of his philosophy, he had to admit that what passes for knowledge is still open to reasonable doubt. That is, he has this religious thirst for certainty. He wants to know the nature of what's real, and he says, in the end, I can't be certain about that. I told you he discovered geometry when he was 11 years old. By the time he was 14, he had abandoned any belief in man's free will, in man's immortality, and God. And he declared that having given up what we think is central to human nature, and having given up God, he was a much happier person as a result. And throughout his life, he tried to convince people to abandon such religious notions of man and God as well. That, of course, brought him into a lot of trouble with people. But having given up a belief in man's dignity, as we would put it, and given up a view of God, it shouldn't surprise us that he would hold to views on sex or war or whatever that would prove to be socially unacceptable and controversial, especially 1920s, 30s, 40s. I've already told you of his conflict at the City College in New York. In the 1950s and 60s, Russell was increasingly involved in protests against thermonuclear war, participated in rallies for disarmament, demonstrations in England, and even at the age of 90, briefly, he was imprisoned for his social activism. Now, what can we say about the philosophical accomplishments of Bertrand Russell, who wanted to use mathematical rigor, logical analysis, to resolve the problems of philosophy and tell us what is real, what's the nature of things? He wanted to make an inventory of those things that comprise the world. But that proved to be a much more difficult task than Bertrand Russell could perform. Indeed, he changed his mind many times throughout his career about the types of entities that are real, that belong to the metaphysical inventory, if you will. When he tried to perform an analysis on linguistic confusions and to bring some kind of logical rigor to his study, he at first thought that the universe was made up of minds, material objects, universals, particulars, and the laws of logic. But then after that, he dropped material objects from the inventory. He dropped minds from the inventory. Later, he replaced particulars with qualities. And with respect to universals, he wanted to eliminate universals altogether, but he said there's one that you will never get rid of, especially if we're going to use set theory, and that's the universal of similarity. We all have to have the notion of similarity. If there is no similarity, then things can't get grouped into sets, right? And so you couldn't drop universals. So what I'm telling you here is that Bertrand Russell, for all of the grandeur of his intellect, his reputation, all of his prizes and so forth, Bertrand Russell was simply unable to accomplish what he wanted, and he changed his views over and over again throughout his life. Let me quote Russell for you. He says, "The business of philosophy as I conceive it is essentially that of logical analysis followed by logical synthesis. Although comprehensive construction is part of the business of philosophy, I do not believe it is the most important part. The most important part, to my mind, consists in criticizing and clarifying notions which are apt to be regarded as fundamental and accepted uncritically. End of quote. And what he says here is, to do the job of a philosopher, you've got to be critically minded. You need to break things down, do analysis, get clear about your concepts. But Russell also said, once you've done that, you don't stop. Now you engage in synthesis. You take these clear concepts and try to build up a constructive view of the world where you have a place for everything. You know what kinds of things exist and you can get rid of nonsense. And so Russell was critically minded, but when he turned around to construct what the universe really is like, to tell us the nature of reality, what I've just indicated is that he went through so many phases that, in a sense, we can't put any stock in what Bertrand Russell concluded, can we? Nevertheless, there was a program, there was something that was, if you will, infusing all the phases of Russell's synthetic philosophy that is worth noting. And I'd like to have you get these characteristics in your notes for Bertrand Russell. Throughout the various phases of his philosophy, Russell always held to this crucial distinction. He said there's a difference between entities about whose existence we are absolutely certain because we're directly aware of them, and those entities whose existence about which we are less than certain because we are led to believe in their existence as a result of inference. That is to say, there's a difference between what we know by direct acquaintance and what we know by description given to us by others. Once again, a clear difference had to be drawn between those things we are absolutely certain about because we directly are aware of them, we're acquainted with them, and then those things, those entities whose existence is less certain to us because we believe in them as a result of inference or description. So the difference between knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description is characteristic of Russell's philosophy. Russell believed in pluralism, that there are many different things in this world, not one mind working its way out, as Hegel thought. And he believed in the rigorous use of analysis to find those pluralities of existence, some of which are known by direct acquaintance, some of which are known by description. And I quote him, "Although I have changed my opinion on various matters, I still hold to the doctrine of external relations and to pluralism, which is bound up with it." Okay, rather than internal relations in the Hegelian or idealistic sense, he said all things are externally related, so there are many realities, not just one. Many things that are real, not just one. "I still hold that an isolated truth may be quite true, that you can examine instances by themselves and know that they are true." By the way, this is something which will be abandoned later by Wittgenstein and even more importantly by the Harvard logician Willard Van Orman Quine. And it's, I think, a monumental observation. You cannot examine sentences in isolation and determine their truth value. All sentences are true or false in virtue of the theory in which they function, of which they are a part. But nevertheless, Russell said, "I still hold that an isolated truth may be quite true. I still hold that analysis is not falsification. I still hold that any proposition other than a tautology, if it is true in virtue of a relation to a fact, and that facts in general are independent of experience." That is, he said there are facts which are facts whether you experience them or not. And sentences which are true in virtue of a relationship they have to the facts. He said, "On all these matters, my views have not changed since I abandoned the teachings of Kant and Hegel." Okay, so we've seen that Russell says there's a difference between knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description. Russell holds that there's a plurality of things that are real, Russell says we need to use the method of analysis to solve our philosophical problems. We can add to this that he was an advocate of what's sometimes called Occam's razor. He was a minimalist. He said we should only admit to our toolbox for explanation. We should only admit among the tools for explanation the fewest entities that we can. He was a minimalist. And if ever it could be shown that something that was used for an explanation, that an explanation referred to things unnecessarily because an equally adequate explanation could be given that doesn't refer to those things, he wanted to eliminate them. Russell held that ordinary language is incoherent and has badly misled philosophers because ordinary language disguises the logical form of truth, of the truths we express. A correct analysis of what we want to say when we speak the truth reveals the logical form of what we're saying, and that, in turn, helps us to solve metaphysical problems. We'll be able to find a solution to metaphysical problems and bypass the traditional question, how do we know? If we do logical analysis, we'll find out what the nature of reality is without having to go through this how do you know what you know phase. Indeed, Russell said, and I quote him, "I reverse the process which has been common in philosophy since Kant. It has been common among philosophers to begin with how we know and proceed afterwards to what we know." Russell said, "I don't want to go through this how you know phase. So let's work out an epistemology, a theory of knowledge, and then we'll apply that epistemology to our experience and determine what we know." Russell said, "I want to begin with what we know and do a logical analysis, and that will show us the nature of what exists." In a lecture that he gave in 1914 entitled Logic as the Essence of Philosophy, Russell declared, "Every philosophical problem, when it is subjected to the necessary analysis and purification, is found either to be not really philosophical at all, or else to be, in the sense in which I am using the word, logical." Okay, so all the major problems of philosophy are going to reduce to being not philosophical problems at all, are resolvable through what? Logic. Well, I hope that these remarks that I'm giving you accurately summarize and help you to appreciate then Russell's orientation to philosophy. Avoid traditional epistemological problems. Prefer logical analysis, because when you do that, you'll either dismiss problems or be able to resolve them. And this will be the key to telling us what kinds of things exist. Well, as I indicated, the problem is Russell went through a number of phases in his life as to what was the nature of the real, those things that truly exist. He had a period in which he held to logical constructionism, a period in which he held what's called neutral monism. We referred to that under William James. He came to some final conclusions later in his life. But most philosophers, if I can try to be impartial in my judgment here, most philosophers see in Russell, again, the model of a person who pushes for logical rigor rather than respecting him for what he actually concluded about the nature of reality, what exists, or what's the nature of the objects of what we the objects of what we know. Now, Russell distinguished between the hard data of our experience, those things we know by acquaintance. I know a Coke can. I'm acquainted with a Coke can. I have directly seen a Coke can. I have not seen the backside of the moon. That's been described to me, however. Or, if we hadn't had somebody describe it. The backside of the moon might be described by inference. So now, given this hard data, soft data distinction, the things we know by inference and description, the things we know by direct acquaintance, Russell said, the problem really is, can the existence of anything other than our own hard data be inferred from the existence of those data? That's the tough question. Russell said, okay, I maintain the only thing you know with certainty is the hard data of direct acquaintance. Now the tough philosophical question is, can we know anything other than the hard data? Can we really know the description of the backside of the moon? Can we really know about sets of numbers and so forth, things we don't directly encounter and experience? And that's the tough question. That's the one that's going to be in our minds until we get to ordinary language analysis. Can we know anything other than our direct experience? Well, Russell struggled and struggled and struggled to try to show that from the hard data of experience, we would be able to infer in some way the truth of the descriptions of things that we have not directly encountered, whether they be sets or, the backside of the moon, although that isn't what he was talking about. The problem was to show that inferences from supposedly hard data to the admittedly soft data can be warranted. Or to put it another way, the problem for Russell was to show that empiricism is compatible with any claim to a knowledge of general truths about nature. Whenever I give a general truth about nature, I'm not telling you something that I have direct acquaintance with. Isn't that right? Because of its general truth. If I gave you a particular truth, the crow on the wire is black, okay, that's hard data. I have a direct encounter with that. But can I tell you anything about crows in general? Well, I've never seen crows in general, have I? And so the real problem is, how do I work from the hard data to the soft data, the generalized conclusion about nature? And here's what I want you to recognize. Russell himself said all of his attempts were a failure. I quote, although our postulates can be fitted into a framework which has what may be called an empiricist flavor, it remains undeniable then our knowledge of them, insofar as we do know them, cannot be based upon experience. In this sense, it must be admitted, empiricism as a theory of knowledge has proved inadequate, though less so than any other previous theory of knowledge. Now, Russell doesn't believe in God. Russell doesn't believe that man has a mind. Russell doesn't believe in moral absolutes in the way that God has revealed them in the Bible. Russell had quite a reputation for that. Russell won the Nobel Prize. Here's a grand and glorious philosopher. Here's a man who's shown us how to use logical rigor. When all is said and done, the king has no clothes. Russell says empiricism is not adequate. I want to say that what we know with certainty is based on direct experience, and all the other things that we want to say are real, the generalizations about nature, sets, things that we haven't seen directly, nevertheless can be warranted by inference from the hard data of experience. And he admits it's an inadequate theory. And the only thing he can say is, but it's not as inadequate as other theories are. That's kind of like a man who died to death slowly because he took strychnine poison. You know, and in the afterlife, he's talking to a man who was shot dead quickly with a gun. And he says, yes, we're both dead, but it took longer for me to die. Empiricism is inadequate, but not as inadequate as it. Well, but if it's inadequate, then you don't know what you say you know. And so, as Russell said, science proves to be at war with itself. When science most wishes to be objective, we only know our direct experiences, the hard data of experience. When science tries to be objective, it plunges itself into subjectivity. Because if we only know our experiences, if we're reduced to physics, physics turns out to show that our realism cannot be justified. We can't move from what we know directly to any other kind of generalization beyond what our direct experience is. And so if you're committed to this realistic, naive, realistic view of the world that takes you to physics, and physics turns around and refutes your naive realism about the world, what kind of philosophy is that? Now, I want you to listen to W.T. Jones, because, again, he's not sympathetic to the Christian world and life view. But as he discusses Russell, he says, though Russell constantly spoke of a realistic, objectivist language, his whole position was infected by a subjectivism from which he extricated himself only by an appeal to irrational belief. And I'm going to give you a quotation. Russell said, in ontology, metaphysics, I start by accepting the truth of physics. Philosophers may say, what justification have you for accepting the truth of physics? I reply, merely a common sense basis. I believe, though without good grounds, in the world of physics as well as in the world of psychology. If we are to hold that we know anything of the external world, we must accept the canons of scientific knowledge. Now here's the kicker. Whether an individual decides to accept or reject these canons is purely a personal affair, not susceptible to argument. Whether an individual decides to accept or reject these canons is a purely personal affair, not susceptible to argument. And as Jones says, this amounts to making science as subjective as Russell held ethics to be. And we're right back to the skepticism of David Hume. Hume had said, ethics is a matter of personal preference. It's just a way of expressing what you have approbation or disapprobation for. But there's no objective foundation for ethics. Well, and when David Hume turned his critical attention to science, he said, in the end, science is based on psychological habit. It's not based on anything we objectively know. There is no causality that you directly have an experience of, so you can't know about causality. Well, now, way back when, on the board, when I was diagramming developments, I said, Hume's skepticism leads to Kant's constructivism, kind of an agnosticism about ultimate reality. We go through all that 19th century stuff, we come into the 20th century, we've seen all these other schools of thought, and then we finally come to a man, Bertrand Russell, inspired by Frege, but nevertheless, Bertrand Russell, who says, if we apply rigorous logical analysis, if we get away from ordinary language and get an ideal language, then we'll be able to understand the nature of the world, what's real. We'll be able to dissolve previous philosophical problems. And then Russell goes through all these phases, different answers. He can't quite get it right. And in the end, he admits failure. He says, empiricism is inadequate. I don't think it's as inadequate as others, but it's inadequate. And then he says, what I believe on the basis of physics. Now, is there an argument for following physics? Whether an individual decides to accept or reject these canons is a purely personal affair, not susceptible to argument. It's just as arbitrary and subjective as ethics. This is the man who said that it was like a religious thirst for faith, that he said we must know what we know with certainty. And the conclusion of his life and his philosophy is, it's not susceptible to argument. I want you to really feel the thrust of this. The man who wanted certainty ends up in subjectivism. Okay, is there a question? Well, because in the process of working out the problems, he had the honesty to say, this theory doesn't work, this doesn't. And he kept trying to apply that logical rigor and so forth. Now, the real question is going to be, did he do this in the right way? I'm going to go back, now that we've kind of done an overview of the philosophy of Russell, his accomplishment or lack thereof, we're going to look at his view, which is called logical atomism. And logical atomism will be picked up by Ludwig Wittgenstein and developed in a pristine form in the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. And you're going to see an interesting conclusion to that. Wittgenstein ends in mysticism and silence, using the rigorous tools of logical analysis, so forth. The logical positivists will pick up on that. They'll try to eliminate all metaphysics, all talk of God, all ethics, and just say all we know are our sense data, our experiences, and nothing else is even meaningful beyond that. You're going to see that those theories become self-contradictory, that the very principle of verification itself cannot be verified. So I'm going to put the question back to you now in a pastoral way. What do you make of the fact that men who have prodigious intellects, I mean, you try to follow Carnap. Rudolf Carnap was a brilliant man. Russell was a brilliant man. Wittgenstein was a brilliant man. All these men who have great, formidable intellects, and they seem to have clean, sharp tools for analysis, and every one of them ends up in failure, self-contradiction, or mysticism. Well, I think we should see in this not just, oh, isn't it tragic, the human drama. I think as Christians we need to learn something from that. The people who will not begin with a proper worldview, in the end, for all of their intellect, can only do damage. Earlier I gave you the metaphor that Cornelius Van Til offers us of a man who has a mind like a buzzsaw, extremely sharp, extremely strong. But you know, you take a buzzsaw that has a lot of power and a very sharp blade, and you try to cut against the grain, and you know what it does for all of its sharpness? It does more damage. It just splinters everything. And that's a good image, I think, for Bertrand Russell, a man who had a brilliant mind, and I don't say this in a coveting way, but I would be happy to have the intellect in the formal, logical ability of a Russell. But the way he tried to use it ended in destruction. Well, let's go back now and look particularly at what Russell had to say about language and linguistic analysis. His view is called logical atomism. And logical atomism advocates what is called the picture theory of language. The picture theory of language. The way to metaphysical knowledge is to develop a language that is purified by logic. And once we purify our language by logical analysis and rigor, then we will have a picture of the world. The problem with ordinary language is it's so sloppy, okay? Got all these problems. So let's regiment it. Let's get rigorous. Let's use an artificial, formal language that will purify out all of the ambiguities and implicit contradictions and difficulties. So a picture theory of language. In a picture theory of language, every sentence in the purified language corresponds to a fact in the world. So every sentence pictures a fact. The cat is on the mat. Pictures this kitty over here on this piece of carpet. The cat is on the mat, that sentence corresponds to a fact in the world. And actually, every word in the sentence, every word comes to correspond to an element of a fact. So if you have this factual situation, what you have out there are things and properties and relations. So let's say it's a black cat on the mat. Here we have a thing, a cat, a property, blackness, a relationship, on, and another thing, a mat. The black cat is on the mat. And so now there is a sentence where every word corresponds to an element in a fact. And so to purify our ordinary language, we must make the sentences of ordinary language correspond to simple facts. We need to take the complex and reduce it to simples. Remember, we're doing analysis. Now, when we do an analysis of statements regarding generalities, we analyze them down into their individual sense data. So here's a generality. The Coke can is on the table. What do I mean by Coke can? Well, that, and we're going to have to be rigorous here, and I'm going to be sloppy and overgeneral, but to analyze what I mean by Coke can, I mean that metal object, which is red, having the following size, shape, texture, whatever. So I start putting together all the simples that make up the thing that I have called Coke can. Or if I talk about the United States invading Haiti. Well, what's the United States? Well, you break down the United States into what? Soldiers and generals and tanks and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it would be very complicated, but the point is all of our language must be purified by being reducible to individual elements, atoms of experience, if you will, where everything that we refer to is either a thing, a property, or a relation. This perfect language, when all is said and done, will consist then in sense data. The perfect language is, say I have an apple that I'm referring to, the perfect language would be red, spherical, crisp, sweet, now. If I did rigorous analysis, the perfect language will come down to temporally qualified sense experiences, sense data. Now, Russell, having proposed this perfect language of logical atomism, said the only thing that is knowable is what can be translated into the perfect language. If you can't translate a sentence into sense data of things, relations, and properties, then it's not knowable. And it's at this point that we're going to make the transition from the philosophy of Bertrand Russell to the philosophy of his most brilliant student, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein's dates are 1889 to 1951. He was from Austria, born in Vienna. He early studied engineering in Berlin and then in Manchester. This took him into an interest in mathematical engineering, which led him to read Frege, and then this led him to Russell and Russell's concerns with mathematical logic. And so in 1912 and 1913, he worked with Bertrand Russell at Cambridge. In World War I, he served in the Austrian Army. And this is significant. Apparently, in reading Tolstoy while he was serving in the Army, had something of a mystical experience that was transforming to him. He became a prisoner of war for a time in Italy. Then in 1921, he published the book that will make him famous for what is known as the early Wittgenstein, because Wittgenstein is going to be carrying out logical atomism for us with brilliance, with elegance. And the conclusion is going to be a total destruction of philosophy. And so Wittgenstein changes his views as he reflects on them and then revolutionizes philosophy for us in the middle of the century. That's known as the later Wittgenstein. But in the early period, that book that gave Wittgenstein his reputation, and for which he was granted his doctorate, by the way, was the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, published in Germany in 1921, the next year in London, 1922. Wittgenstein apparently had a family fortune of sorts that he had inherited because of his reading of Tolstoy, and whatever that mystical experience was. He had given away most of his money and had become an elementary school teacher in Austria. And during this time, he did correspond with philosophers. He corresponded with members of the Vienna Circle. We're going to come to that in a few minutes. And in 1929, he came back to Cambridge, now permanently. And accepted the chair of philosophy that previously had been held by G.E. Moore. And then in 1947, he resigned from that chair of philosophy at Cambridge. He had deteriorating health and died of cancer in 1951. So the early Wittgenstein, before he goes back to Cambridge in the second phase of this incredible career, writes the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and according to it, the world is made up of elementary facts, and these elementary facts are the subject matter of empirical science. And so this rigorous system, by the way, the Tractatus is divided into seven propositions, and then he gives qualifications and argumentation for the seven. So it amounts to seven declarations. And according to it, the world is made up of elementary facts, logical atomism, and those facts are what we study in empirical science. So the world is, from a cognitive standpoint, the world of science, what empirical science tells us. Anything beyond what you can talk about is unknowable. And the reason for that is you can't speak it. If you're going to be a logical atomist, if you're going to have this purified ideal language, anything that's beyond that language is unspeakable and therefore unknowable. But this is what's interesting about the life of Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein admitted, however, there is a realm that is unknowable. It is unknowable, but there is such a realm, and he called it Das Mystique, the mystical. There is a realm of the mystical, but you cannot speak of it cognitively. Sound like anybody we've studied before, class? Thank you. We have the objects of science. You can know about them. You can know there's a realm beyond it, but it's all unknowable after that, the mystical. Now, of course, Russell's logical atomism and the development of it, and Wittgenstein's Tractatus, drawing out these conclusions where you can only know what is sayable in the perfect language, would be very congenial to people who want to get rid of God, religion, ethics, human responsibility, and so forth. All of these things are beyond the perfect language. All of these things do not picture facts in our experience, things, properties, and relations, and therefore you cannot know such things. So this is the end of the matter. Wittgenstein realized, as he developed the Tractatus down to its end, that if what he's saying is true, the only things that are knowable are those things expressed in the perfect language of logical atomism, then the things he's been saying in the Tractatus can't be known because they cannot be translated into the perfect language of logical atomism. Most philosophy, but most particularly the Tractatus itself, he admitted, violates the restrictions that he was advocating in the Tractatus. Well, that's the meanest, cruelest contradiction of all, when you contradict yourself. And so at the end of the Tractatus, he rejects his own statements as meaningless. Explicitly. In fact, let me quote you the end of the book. Here's the mystical passage with which this rigorous, logical, empirical philosophy ends. Okay, let's give that quotation again. At the end of the Tractatus, he says, "My propositions are elucidatory in this way. He who understands me finally recognizes them as senseless when he has climbed out through them, on them, over them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up on it. He must surmount these propositions, then he sees the world rightly. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent." That's powerful stuff. Wittgenstein says, "I've given you this pure, scientific, logical ladder that you can climb up. Oh, by the way, and when you get to the top, you realize you have to kick the ladder away because it didn't have any cognitive meaning either." And so when you come to the end, at least he had this honesty. He said, "Whereof one cannot speak." He said, "You really can't speak in the way that I am speaking. The restrictions I've laid down don't just apply to God and religion and ethics and so forth, but to my own philosophy. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent." And Wittgenstein gave up philosophy and went away to the Black Forest and taught little children. These are powerful spiritual lessons, not just observations about the history of philosophy. Bertrand Russell starts with a religious thirst for certainty and clarity. And he ends up admitting that his epistemology is inadequate, and if you want to follow it, it's all a matter of subjective choice. Bertrand Russell, the brilliant student of, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the brilliant student of Bertrand Russell, carries out the program of logical atomism in the Tractatus, and it concludes by saying, "We've got to be silent. We can't say anything. Cognitively, we cannot know anything with that kind of certainty at all." We're going to turn from logical atomism now to logical positivism. Logical positivism is usually identified with a group of scholars known as the Vienna Circle. The Vienna Circle was a reform movement, obviously centered at the University of Vienna, which flourished in the 1920s and 1930s. Logical positivism in the Vienna Circle worked toward achieving a scientific philosophy that would eliminate all pseudo-propositions, particularly the propositions of metaphysics. The Vienna Circle, or the logical positivist, had as their main concern the logic of science and the elimination of metaphysics as pseudo-philosophy, pseudo-language. Some of the names connected with the Vienna Circle, and I just feel really discouraged that we can't go into each one of them and give some biography and each one's contribution, but you should know the Vienna Circle was identified with Morris Schlick, S-C-H-L-I-C-K, Carl Hempel, Herbert Feigl, F-E-I-G-L, and particularly these two names, Rudolf Carnap, C-A-R-N-A-P, who eventually migrated to UCLA to teach philosophy, and A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R, A.J. Ayer, who was perhaps the leading popularizer of the outlook of logical positivism. these philosophers or philosophers of science connected with the Vienna Circle were really intrigued with the outlook of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. They thought this would enable them to develop that philosophy of science that they were hoping to develop, the ideal language to solve our problems, okay, would be the language of science given logical rigor. So the Tractatus seemed like a real stepping stone for them. But then they didn't like the self-refuting character of the Tractatus, and they certainly didn't like the affirmation of mysticism in Wittgenstein. But they did adopt that approach, the linguistic analytical approach, a purified language, and they also represented some of the blown-up and proud pretensions of Auguste Comte and others on the continent of Europe, who maintained that if we're going to solve our problems, mankind needs to get back to science. Okay. Now you, again, understand what I'm talking about, because even though you may not have studied with or lived next door to any logical positivist, this is what people with a scientific mentality, popular, I mean, this is the 1920s and 30s, but it filters down to the popular level. And so in your lives, you know people who think, well, that's it. The language of science is the pure language, and if we just followed the language of science, we could solve our problems. Well, the Vienna Circle wanted to accomplish that. They thought the Tractatus would help them do it. But they had to revise logical atomism. They rejected the picture theory of language. They said language is not an attempt to picture the world. Cat, black, on, mat. That is not an attempt to picture the world. The task of philosophy is rather to clarify the language of science and to regiment it so that we can use the language of science for analytical purposes. And in so doing, in using the language of science, we reject all metaphysics. Philosophy is not a means of discovering any truths about reality that are unavailable in any other department of the university. Philosophers have no special access to the realm of reality. Philosophers can help us as scientists get our language in better shape, clean it up, be more logically rigorous, but philosophy itself cannot tell us anything about reality. Well, according to the logical positivist, what kinds of meaningful language are there? Well, there are, first of all, logical tautologies. The brown dog is brown is a logical tautology, because if you understand the subject of that sentence, the predicate adds nothing to it. It's just saying A is A, ultimately. The brown thing is brown. The brown thing is a brown thing. Now, that's meaningful, but then, of course, not very interesting, not very helpful or informative. It's just a trivial tautology. Contradictions are meaningful. Contradictions are meaningful. They're false. What they're saying is false, but at least they make sense. They have meaning. And then finally, there are the statements based on empirical experience. Statements based on empirical experience can be true or false. So everything that is meaningful, according to the logical positivist, is either true or false. All other language is put in the category of emotive language. So poetry, ethical commands, questions that people have, all of that's emotive language. Descriptive language has cognitive meaning because descriptive language is either true or false. And the only possibilities we have then are tautologies. Are they meaningful? Yes, because they are true. Or you have contradictions, which are meaningful, and they are false. And then you have things which are empirically verified. Those things we know from direct experience of the world. And we have those things which are empirically disconfirmed. So, using empirical methods, we can take a statement and either verify it or disconfirm it. And that means it can be true or false. So that's the limit of the sayable in the perfect language, the ideal or purified language of logical positivism. Now this is expressed in what's called the verification principle. The verification principle of meaningfulness. For any statement that is cognitively meaningful, it must be verifiable by logic or positive empirical experience, hence logical positivism. It must be verifiable by logic or positive empirical experience, which means verifiable by the methodology of science. Well, boy, we've really reached a high and mighty position, haven't we? Science is up here dismissing religion, dismissing ethics, dismissing everything that cannot finally pass its rigorous and restrictive standards. Well, you'd think that's the end of philosophy there. I mean, they've got it sewn up, right? Well, there's one minor problem, if I can speak tongue-in-cheek, and that's that the logical positivists can't pass their own test. What did I say the most cruel form of contradiction is? Self-contradiction. So, let me simplify my critique for the sake of time. I really don't want to leave here without you at least knowing the core problem. I'm going to write the verification principle up here. And I will put it in quotes, but I mean for it not to be the words verification principle, but this will stand for a full statement of the verification principle. Whatever is meaningful must be verifiable by logic or empirical, positive empirical experience. Now, we know that the verification principle, the statement between these quotations, if it is meaningful, must either then be a logical truth, or it must be something that is verifiable by positive empirical experience. Now, if it's a logical truth, that's not going to be a happy conclusion. Because if it's only a logical truth, it's trivial. It's like saying, A is A. The dog is the dog. It doesn't tell us anything if it's only a logical truth. It doesn't get us out to the world and give us any information. So if the verification principle is going to be helpful, it has to be an empirical principle, doesn't it? And now all of a sudden you see the problem, don't you? And that's that the verification principle itself is not any of the things that we experience. Has anybody ever empirically experienced the verification principle? I don't mean the verification principle written on a board
that you've experienced the, if you will, the expression of it.
I know we can experience language, but has anybody ever experienced what that language is supposed to refer to? Our principles, our guidelines, the sorts of things that we can ever experience empirically? Well, now this is a terribly embarrassing position to be in. The verification principle rules itself out as cognitively meaningful. Now, A.J. Ayer, in the book Language, Truth, and Logic, is the philosopher who particularly gave popular expression to the verification principle. And had we the time, maybe we need a whole course on modern analytical philosophy so Dr. Bahnsen can go into all the things he wants. But if we had the time, I'd love to show you the various generations of or developments of the argument back and forth on this. The conclusion that you're just going to have to take my word for, but I'll be glad to give you the bibliography, is that A.J. Ayer was thoroughly demolished. Every version of the verification principle that he offered turned out to either allow any kind of statement or to rule itself out as well. It was either too loose or it was too tight. Well, so obviously logical positivism has come to grief. You start with Russell, religious thirst for certainty, clarity. He ends up by saying it's a matter of subjective choice. We go to Wittgenstein, who is going to regiment this logical atomism. He ends up saying, we can't even speak about what I've been speaking about. We go to the logical positivists, and they maintain that philosophy is really just to help science get its language and its logic in order. And the verification principle of these positivists proves to rule itself out, or, on the other hand, to rule everything in, even the things they don't want to be there. So an attempt is made to salvage the scientific prejudices and flavor of this through a development known as, well, that's been advanced by Karl Popper, an English philosopher of science, Karl Popper, who, by the way, just died 2 weeks ago. Karl Popper suggested, well, then, a statement is cognitively meaningful not when it can be verified, but it's meaningful if it's open to falsification. Now, let's be sure we're hearing this right. Popper doesn't say meaningful statements are those which are false. What he's saying is they're statements which are open to falsification. And if there's nothing which could theoretically falsify the statement, then it's not a meaningful statement at all. Well, now we have another problem, and that's that there's no way you can ever falsify any particular declaration. Any particular declaration. If I say there is a white crow, can that be falsified? In theory, even. Can it be falsified? Somebody says, well, we've looked at all the crows. And I'll say, how could you ever look at all the crows? Once you've looked at all the crows of which you're aware, I can say, and the white one hasn't been found yet, but there is a white crow. Now, that's not subject to empirical falsification. And yet it's obviously a meaningful statement. And so the verification principle leaves the door wide open to anything, or contradicts itself, in which case it's not meaningful. And the falsification principle, advanced by Karl Popper, doesn't allow for even obvious statements of science or pseudoscience to be considered meaningful, cognitively meaningful, because they can't ever be falsified. The particular statements of them, anyway. And so other versions that have tried to rescue cognitive meaningfulness based on some kind of scientific prejudice or empirical prejudice about the world have been offered. What you usually get is something like this. A statement is meaningful if some empirical evidence is relevant to its truth or falsity, if some empirical evidence could bear on its truth or its falsity. Well, stop and think about it. That kind of swings the door open, right? Because all kinds of metaphysical, religious, ethical statements could not be rejected on that basis because there's some empirical evidence that's relevant to them. In fact, I would argue from our Orthodox Christian perspective that those statements that have absolutely no empirical relevance, even in theory, we would want to reject too. Somebody comes in and says, not nothing's itself. I don't think it's wrong for us to, as Christians, to say, you know, you're not saying anything. You know, and you take some modern theologians, Paul Tillich may be a good example. You know, Paul Tillich says that that God is beyond being and non-being. Wow. Now, what would falsify that statement? Or what application in the material world would be made that is distinct from any other application? Here's another way of putting it. Isn't everything that we know in our empirical experience, everything we know in our empirical experience, and all the theoretical experiences, everything we know is compatible with that? And the opposite of the things we know would also be compatible with that. So it's just gobbledygook. It's nonsense. So there's something to that. But then again, what are you saying? It's not that big a deal to say there must be some empirical relevance in the statement. Okay. You try to be more restrictive than that, you're either going to contradict yourself or you're going to fail in your program. And my conclusion is, linguistic analysis following the program of the ideal language proved to be a failure.
As we entered this unit of 20th century thought,
in advance I told you that logical and linguistic analysis can take you one of two directions. Just reminding you here by putting it on the board, linguistic analysis can take you in the direction of an ideal language, a purified language, or linguistic analysis can focus not on trying to purify language, make it fit into the language of science or the language of logic and so forth, but it can focus on ordinary language. A few minutes ago in the lecture, I said, when Wittgenstein finished the Tractatus, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent, he was silent, went away from philosophy. And then after a period of silence, he returned to philosophy. Was not a logical positivist, had been rethinking the ideas of the Tractatus based on what the positivists tried to do with it. And in fact had developed a radically different approach to language. And so in the 1930s, we begin to see the development of that approach in what is called the Blue and Brown books, but its best expression is in his Philosophical Investigations. The story of that book alone is fascinating. I have to be brief. Wittgenstein would lecture at Cambridge by coming in and putting down a stool and sitting there and just kind of thinking out loud. And his students would sit there and take notes as he'd think through things and then dialogue with himself and so forth. And from what I've told, I don't think this is apocryphal, sometimes there'd be long periods of silence. You come in and he'd say something, and then it's kind of like the register gets stuck, and you go, where do you go from here? You know, you hem and haw and so forth, and that'd be it. I mean, watch this poor guy struggle. But nevertheless, as he develops this new approach to language, his students take notes. And as far as we know, Wittgenstein never wrote out this approach. There are notations on scraps of paper that were found in shoeboxes. But his students took their notes and his notations, the scraps and shoeboxes, and put together what is called the philosophical investigations. Well, what is the ordinary language approach to analysis? Well, if we go back to logical atomism, remember that the ideal language was supposed to picture the world so that every element in a sentence refers to something in experience. Wittgenstein said that's totally unrealistic. Language has far more to do, has many more functions than simply to picture the facts of experience. What logical atomism and then logical positivism had done is that they ignored all those other things that we find in ordinary language and narrowly and artificially focused just on the language of science and empirical experience, the language of description or acquaintance. But think about it. Language does much more than describe the world. Language is used to do what? Well, to make promises to people. Language is used to joke with people, to greet people. Language is used in poetry, in literature, in the theater. Language is used to pretend. Language is used to curse. And on it goes. Language serves many purposes, not just description. And according to Wittgenstein, we don't accomplish anything by artificially trying to rule out all these other forms of language or all these uses of language as somehow meaningless. They're not meaningless. Even if they aren't intending to convey information, they are not in themselves meaningless. We don't need a perfect language because, according to Wittgenstein, who, by the way, had done the best at developing such a thing, he said there is no perfect language that can be developed that will serve all purposes. So that now what we should recognize is that the meaning of language is found in its usage. In which case, all kinds of language, not just scientific, not just the language of direct empirical acquaintance, but all language is meaningful and has a legitimate use among some group of people. If an expression is used in a linguistic community, it is meaningful in that community. And so, Wittgenstein rejected the reductionism of logical atomism and logical positivism. Let's not try to reduce meaning just down to the language of science. That's artificial. And he also rejected the idea that you can reduce all complex facts to simple facts. He rejected the idea that vague language needs to be made precise.